If the committee would please come to order. Welcome everybody back this afternoon. Committee first on our agenda for this afternoon's segment will be healthcare industry, Stephen Millard and Bob Ficker with us today. Gentlemen, welcome. If you'd please take the podium in whatever fashion that you put your presentations together, and as soon as you're prepared, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Steve Millard. I'm the President and CEO of the Idaho Hospital Association. So good to be with you today, and thank you for the invitation to present to you. There is a handout that you have. I don't have a PowerPoint. I came to this party a little bit late, so I didn't have a chance to do a PowerPoint for you. But the handout has the data on it that is important for your discussions. First of all, the Idaho Hospital Association has been working with the University of Idaho for about 3 years now to do an economic impact study on the impact that hospitals, just hospitals in the healthcare field, have on the state's economy. And through that, these studies measure not only the direct impacts of employment, expenditure and taxes, but also the indirect and induced impacts through the use of conservatively established multipliers that are unique not only to hospitals, hospital-based healthcare, but also to the counties in which these hospitals are located. So for 2010, the first question on the questions for the presenters was, what is the percentage of this gross state product that our industry contributes? That number, as you can see on that sheet, for 2010 is 5.8%. And that totals over $3.12 billion. That's a fairly significant percent for only a sector of the healthcare industry. That's just hospitals, and that's just community hospitals. That's based on fiscal data from 2009. Now the next question is, what was your forecast, what is your forecast growth in your industry for the current state fiscal year and the upcoming fiscal year? That's a little bit harder to come up with. Over the last 2 to 3 years, our hospitals have seen declines in volumes for elective procedures. As you can imagine, as the economy sours, people put those things off. There's also higher volumes of patients who've lost their medical insurance, and there are those who have postponed their insurance or their medical treatments because until they're more critical, because they can't either afford to pay for them out of their own pocket. They don't have insurance. They don't qualify for any of the social programs. These scenarios have resulted in significant belt tightening across the community hospitals in Idaho. While there is optimism about the economic future, Idaho's community hospitals are still very cautious about anticipating growth. As with many other industries, hospitals are not looking forward to statistically significant growth in the next 2 years. But in addition to decreasing volumes, you might guess that would come along with significant increases in bad debt, and that is actually the facts. In 2009, community hospitals reported over $126 million in bad debt, and that's for patients who should be able to pay who didn't pay. There's also the aspect of charity care. And in same fiscal year, 2009, Idaho's community hospitals continued to work hard to take care of their communities, providing over $47 million in charity care, which is up $10 million from the prior year. And then with the jobless rate continuing at record levels, there's been a corresponding loss of people with insurance and income, and we continue to see high volumes of bad debt and more requests for charity care than in recent history. While we anticipate the growth to be minimal, hospitals and healthcare professionals continue to implement improvements and efficiencies in healthcare that not only lead to higher quality care, but also to make more out of every dollar that is spent. Hospitals continue to experience decreases in reimbursement for Medicaid and Medicare. You know the Medicaid story. We've been through that last year and the year before. We'll go through it again this year, I'm sure. Combined, the unreimbursed care provided to Idaho patients through Medicare, Medicaid, and other government programs like the county and the Gen 10 CAT Fund, reached $202 million for 2009. $202 million. That's unreimbursed care from the government payers. Now, these are costs of providing care. That's not the charges. That's the cost of providing care. Then on a high note, this is a very high note for us, with the passage of HJR 4 in the recent election, there was some pent-up demand in some of the hospitals to do improvements that they'd been holding on to until this passed. Now, you're not going to see an explosion of construction in the healthcare industry in Idaho, but you're going to see some of these projects come to fruition that they'd been on hold until then. So there'll be a small uptick in construction. We do know that there are several hospitals that were in construction that weren't affected by the Frazier decision, like Portneuf Medical Center in Pocatello. It was affected early on, but it changed its status, so it was able to get capital to build. They are opening their new facility this spring. The St. Luke's facility in Twin Falls is opening within the next 12 to 24 months. And there's also some new construction that have been approved in St. Mary's and also at Bear Lake Memorial Hospital in Montpelier. So there will be some activity in that regard. It's not going to be a huge amount. We don't see any of the larger hospitals doing anything in the next couple of years. The next question is, what is the current state of your industry? How do sales compare to a year ago? I would say it's steady. It's about the same. It's holding its own. It's not increasing. It's not decreasing. Then how many people are employed in your industry, and how does that compare to a year ago, and how does the payroll compare? Over 23,000 people are directly employed by Idaho's community hospitals, and that was reported at the end of 2010, so it's very, very recent numbers. And we believe hospital employment remains steady, but it isn't expected to make any significant increases in the next couple of years. Payroll, and by the way, the average salary for hospital employees is $42,822. It's a very, very high-paying job venue, and they also provide benefits for most of their employees, even the part-time employees. When you take into account the economic impacts that are assessed as a result of the 23,000 employees, community hospitals account for more than 57,000 Idaho jobs. The next question is, how much of the state sales tax and income tax is due to your industry? And hospitals are a significant driver of Idaho's taxes, both as large employers and as significant purchasers of goods and services. The overall impact of Idaho's hospitals on property sales and excise taxes reached $115 million. When you consider sales taxes paid by some hospitals, as well as the hospital employees buying goods and services, hospitals had a $55 million impact on the state sales tax. How does your industry impact other businesses? We have quality jobs, good pay, good benefits. Jobs are created in this industry. Healthcare continues to be a vital and dynamic field with significant variety of career opportunities. There's also community growth and stability. Most communities don't grow unless they have a high-quality hospital in their area. The next question is, do you know of any companies that are planning on moving operations in or out of the state? The answer to that is no. I don't know of anybody that's going to do that. Do you see the consolidation in your industry in the future, and if so, do you anticipate impacts on the local economy? That's a very good question. It's very applicable to healthcare right now. With healthcare reform looming in Washington and what's coming down over the next decade, and we all know that may change, but hospitals are going to be forced into, and it's probably a good thing, to be more integrated, more coordinated, and to do things more collaboratively than they ever have in their history. I can envision a day when a small rural hospital in Idaho will not be able to stand alone and make it. He's going to have affiliations with larger medical centers, maybe even whether it's ownership or affiliations or whatever. So that is a looming thing for healthcare in Idaho. I think it's a good thing because we have to coordinate and integrate care if we're going to take the costs out of it. Now the last question I'll attempt to answer is on the general economy, is there any potential federal legislation that you may be aware of that could impact the Idaho economy? I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. People like to call it Obamacare. That's sitting out there. And that it will have a major impact on our economy. It will have a major impact on the local economy. What that impact is, we don't know. They're still writing regulations to implement it. We know the House is going to, the Congressional House is going to have a vote on repealing this probably next week. We also know it will probably pass the House. It will probably not pass the Senate. Even if it did, it will get vetoed. So Obamacare, if you want to call it that, is still going to be with us for at least 2 years, and we're going to have to prepare for it. And it's going to be important for hospitals to be ready for it. We're gearing up to help our members do that. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have to say, but I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Steve. Representative Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Stephen. I have a couple of questions. Unfortunately, you know where I'm from, and you know the medical community there has really grown. But just a clarification on in your employment section, you said payroll is down from 09 to 10 by 7%. Payroll, do you mean the dollars paid in the health care employees was down, or is that the number of people employed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, I should have clarified that. That was in my notes. I skipped over that. That is dollars less. I don't think the number of employees are up, but the dollars are down. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Stephen, a follow-up. Our concern here is employment, putting people back to work and so forth. Is the availability of a skilled workforce a limitation to what, to your optimism on how many more people we could put to work in the healthcare industry? Now, I understand you represent just hospitals, and the healthcare industry is broader, but what's your comment? You're an expert in this field. Is the availability of a skilled workforce a limitation? Do we need to train more people?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson, that's a very good question. Let me try to answer it this way. I can tell you that before the economy went south, we had a shortage of nurses. So in that regard, yes. When the economy went south, a lot of nurses put off their retirements, came out of retirement, went back to work because they were staying home with their children, and there is not a nursing shortage today. There will be another nursing shortage though, as the economy turns around. So quick answer from the nursing perspective is yes. Now there's probably a more serious problem than that, and that's having enough physicians to take care of the population. We have an age wave coming up, the baby boomers. I'm first year baby boomer. We're going to hit the market, the healthcare market, if you will, one of these days really soon. Actually, my retirement day is next year. I don't think I'm going to make it next year, but we're going to be needing healthcare services, and we're not going to have enough people to take care of them. And we don't have enough primary care physicians, mainly. That is where we're really lacking. So I guess the one word answer to your question is yes.
Representative McGeehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Steve. I'm interested in policies that will work to reduce health care costs, and in the Medicaid budget, payments to hospitals is the highest category of expenditure. Have you thought, can you give us some ideas that you could present to us as legislators that would work to help you, the hospitals, reduce their costs, and then in turn we can help reduce health care costs in general?
Lamar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGeehan, I think the last 5 years I have talked about with many folks, legislators, businesses, and other organizations about what we have to do with our healthcare system to make it more affordable. And there's a number of things that can be done, but it has to be better coordinated. Providers, and I'll call use the broad word providers to mean physicians, hospitals, physical therapists, nurses, all have to be on the same page, coordinating care, so that if I go to one doctor and get an MRI done, and I have to go to another, I'm referred to another doctor, I don't have to have the MRI repeated. We currently deliver healthcare in silos. We've got to get out of the silos and coordinate care. Now, to do that in the short term is very, very difficult. Some of the reform measures in the national bill will help get us there, but they're ways down the road. So what we can do in Idaho to help the hospitals reduce their costs, reduction regulations is certainly a place to look at. I can't tick off any of it, except I've been looking at a bill that's aimed at the indigent program, and what I've seen, it will probably increase the hospital's costs because it makes it so complex. We've got to simplify things and simplify rules and regulations. We've got to make it so different providers can work together. There are some federal barriers in the way, antitrust, for example. The Stark laws, for example. There are a number of things that get in the way. And I think most of it has to be done on the federal level. Now, last year, if you recall, House Bill 626, I believe, was the bill that hospitals actually put $25 million a year on the table, reductions in Medicaid reimbursement to help the state out. And we're still in that thing. I don't know what else we can do in terms of giving up, the hospitals can do, because it's not my money, their money. I don't know what else we can do to have them give up more money. But certainly, that was a big thing for our members to do, and they did it willingly to help the situation.
Senator Folter.
Thanks, Steve. And, you know, one of the comments you made struck home for me personally here. I just want to take 15 seconds and share just a little personal story. In the last 36 months, I had two minor rotator cuff surgeries, outpatient, basically the same procedure twice. One of those procedures was done at a private hospital here in the Valley. The other one was done at one of the major nonprofits. Same procedure, same amount of time, within a very short period of time. My hospital bill from the private hospital was $8,000. My hospital bill from the nonprofit was right under $30,000. If I'd have known, I would have gone to the private one both times. I didn't know that. So the point you made about trying to consolidate in order to save costs is not flying with me right now. The other thing that I would say is that I realize we've got a big indigent care number that we have to cover, but 22,000 on one procedure for one patient, that seems like that's a pretty big gap. If you care to comment, that's great. If not, we can take offline, but I had to say something just with what I've been through.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Folger, I'd love to comment on that. The what you call private hospital is a physician-owned specialty hospital. That is a different business model than a nonprofit hospital that has an emergency department and takes everybody that comes through the door, to include the indigent patients, the Medicaid patients, and the uninsured. The private hospital doesn't do any of that. They operate on people. They do surgery, period. It's like St. Luke's Surgery Department. If a community hospital could just do surgery, they would have the same crisis as that hospital. Probably less, because it would be doing it not for profit. It's a different business model. There's a niche for those, but they don't have to pay for the departments that don't generate revenue. They don't have an emergency department. They don't have obstetrics. They don't have any of the other things that these the array of services that the other hospitals do. So what if we get into a situation where every hospital develops that model? Where do you get your emergency care? Where do the uninsured go? Where do the Medicaid patients go? There's a good reason there's a cost difference. There's a reimbursement difference, too, to those by the government payers, because they recognize it's lower cost. It's not always higher quality. There is an issue called self-referral, physicians referring to a facility in which they have an ownership interest. There are studies around the country, including one in Idaho, that shows physician ownership leads to higher utilization. And so you may get your one case maybe less than it would be at one of the community hospitals, but if they're doing more of the same thing, particularly with respect to imaging and those types of things, it can cost you more in the long run. So you're not comparing apples to apples when you make those comparisons. I didn't really want to get into that. That wasn't part of my idea, but you asked the question.
Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm crossing the line too, but we had a very contentious bill that we refer to as any willing provider. I would be interested in hearing your observations on that, since I expect it'll be back.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen.
Yeah,
I think it'll be back. We've had discussions about it already with Representative Anderson and others. It's the same issue. It's the specialty hospital versus the others and nonprofit non-insurance networks. We're going to be in the same position we were before. We don't believe that the bill ought to be expanded.
Representative Brookline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Millard, as you know, we have to come up with a revenue projection. And one of the things that intrigues me about revenue projections is that if we were to substantially cut the Medicaid budget, I'm interested in what you may think might be the negative economic impacts of that and therefore further negative tax revenue impacts from people either losing their jobs or hiring not happening or other impacts that your industry has on the economy. Do you have any comments about that?
Mr. Millard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burgoyne, I don't have numbers, but intuitively, and depending on how you would cut Medicaid, if you cut reimbursement, the hospitals are eating more money, passing it on to the other payers. If you cut services, you get more uninsured. They still get seen at our community hospitals, but they don't get seen at the hospitals like the one that Senator Fulcher went to. So wherever you cut, you're going to push out the balloon, you know, that old analogy about pushing the balloon. It would have major impact on anything as far as I see it. Either the patients don't have a place to get care, or they can't pay for it. If they still get care if they come to one of our hospitals, they have to. We're required by law to take them because we offer emergency services. There's federal law called EMTALA that requires that. If you have emergency services, you take them.
Senator Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, thank you for being here today. You know, I'm always curious when I hear that Idaho has the fewest numbers of doctors per capita, and I don't distrust those numbers, but do we really have a shortage of doctors?
Mr. Millard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Geddes, I think we do, particularly primary care doctors. Those would be your family medicine specialties, pediatricians, obstetricians. The big one is the... I can't think of it. They take care of the older people, not gerontologists, but there's internists. It was probably 20 years ago, there was a situation in Boise. All the internists left town for some reason. There wasn't a Medicare-age patient that could find a doctor. St. Luke's went out and hired a bunch of internists and created the St. Luke's Internal Medicine Clinic, which still exists today. Before that, nobody could get a doctor. So, yeah, I think there's a big shortage of those. There may be a maldistribution of the specialists there may not be a shortage overall, but there's areas of the state that can't get specialty care as well.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have a follow-up.
Follow-up.
You know, I was really interested and fascinated by one comment. My friend Sean Ellis is here, so I'm going to ask you this. As a former Benville, why would you go to the University of Idaho to have a hospital study completed, where Idaho State has the mission of medical education and probably more expertise, not to mention the fact that they have one of the most accomplished business schools in our state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gage, I'm not sure how to answer that. I'm a Bengal by education. We went to the University of Idaho probably 30 years ago for our first economic impact study. Interestingly enough, the guy that did then is still there and doing it. At that time, I don't know that ISU had the capability of doing an economic impact study like we were trying to get done. That's my only defense. Sorry.
Senator Lefebvre. Senator Getty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve and Bob, I'd like to thank both of you, Bob, ahead of time for pinch hitting in this area. We didn't have anyone that could tell us about what to expect for health care, and you filled in at the last minute and did a great job.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I probably took up all Bob's time, too.
I think he's okay with that. Any further questions, committee? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you, committee.
Welcome again, Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Fick. I work for the Department of Labor. I can do this fairly quickly. I think Ray, well, first of all, Ray gave you the release today on unemployment. Clearly, the last comments I made yesterday were wrong. We are now ahead of the, have a higher rate than the national rate at 9.5%. The national rate is 9.4. We were 9 years and 2 months under the national rate. I don't know that this is much of a big deal, but it's kind of a down note to end 2010. I think Ray handed out five pages of spreadsheets. The first one you've got in your packet. The only difference is this one has two columns at the end that show what the median and average wages are for the jobs in the major sectors of the economy. And then they're ranked by growth over the long term through 2018. And you'll see that healthcare support operations and healthcare practitioners and technical occupations are two of the top three, healthcare support being the top one. They're 34 and 27% growth over this period. This is another case where percentages don't really tell you the whole story. You'll see also that the combination of those two sectors is 14,000 jobs increase of the 111,000 jobs that will increase over that 10-year period. So we're talking about less than 10% of the increase, and the total employment is about 50,000 jobs out of 700 and over 700,000. So while this is a very stable sector, it's a sector that will grow because the population is increasing, even if it increases at a slower rate, and it's aging at the same time. It's not a sector that offers a lot of additional employment. The wages, and if you go to the second page, you'll see the short-term projections, and the fourth, there's two pages of those, and the fourth page is long-term projections. What these are projections by the individual occupations. And you'll notice in each case that there are only three occupations in the healthcare sector where there will be more than 100 jobs added per year. That's registered nurses, which Steve's already talked about, and we are doing a more detailed update of a study we did a year ago about the entire nursing situation and Idaho's capacity to train nurses. That report should be done about the end of this month, I believe. But it's registered nurses, and the registered nurses make in the high 20s an hour. It's a good job, and it has generates a lot of spendable income. The other two are in the healthcare support occupations, and those are home health care aides and nursing aides and orderlies. And these are people that make $9, $10, $11 an hour. They generate a couple hundred jobs a year, new jobs a year, but you're talking about jobs that you may well be financing a Medicare, a Medicaid support, or food stamp support for, depending on how big the families are and the people who hold these jobs down. The same is the case in the long-term projections for registered nurses and these home health care and aides, nursing aides. As I said, the nursing, we have a report coming out on nursing. Nursing is one of the high-paying occupations in the healthcare sector. There's also in this first page of the short-term projections, you'll see a section about counselors and social workers. I knocked out all the ones that weren't health-related, and you'll see that the ones that are left that are relatively health-related do pay a fairly decent wage, somewhere between $17 and $22 an hour. The wages we view as important because they are what generates economic activity. The gross state product, which is a statistic that people are paying more attention to now, 57% of the gross state product is wages. So the higher wages go, the higher gross state product goes. And then about 40% of it is business profits. And the other thing about healthcare is while it's very stable and it will grow, it doesn't generate a lot of jobs outside of itself. The multiplier on healthcare is right around 1, depending on what the job is. The doctor is going to generate a little more business, a little more employment than a nurse or a home healthcare aide. But overall, the multiplier is 1. I mean, if you're looking for ways to increase jobs by generating jobs, dairy is a great one because the multiplier is like 6 or 7 because of the entire supply chain that goes from the cow all the way up to the truck that carries the cheese to the market that sells the cheese. You don't have that same kind of thing in healthcare. It's generally the job it creates is the job it creates, and there's not a whole lot of follow-up from that. I'd be glad to take any questions or just email me questions if you come up with them later. I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fick. Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fick, I'll go back to the news release that you sent out. Can you tell us what that means for the future, whether or not this was a surprise, and if so, does that have any effect on the report you gave us yesterday?
No, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hill, as I said yesterday, I didn't expect, and I didn't think anybody at the Department of Labor expected, that the rate in December would vary much from the rate in November. It was 9.4, went up 9.5. Up or down a tenth is really statistically insignificant. What was unexpected is when I woke up this morning, turned on the radio, and heard that the national rate went down 0.4. I mean, that's one of the largest one-month drops the national rate's ever had. I felt worse when I realized that what I had said yesterday is now totally wrong. And there is the prospect that in the next 2 months, as these numbers go through benchmarking and we look at additional information like wage reports from employers and more detailed information from claims, that these numbers could change. I'll point out that in 2007, when the benchmark occurred, we had a 2007, the unemployment rate went from like 3.1 in January down to 2.3 in July or August, and back up to 3 in December. Which is big U, which mirrors the economy. We have higher unemployment in the winter than we do in the summer, so we have really good employment. When they benchmarked it, they made a straight line, 2.7 all the way through September, and then 2.8 the last 3 months of the year. And then when they re-benchmarked it the year after that, we got what we have now, which is a little less volatile, but the low was 2.7 in 2007, and the high, I think, was about 3.2 or 3.3, and we had that curve back again. But that's what can happen in benchmarking, and likely that's what will happen. Whether the rate for November, December is adjusted down or up, I can't tell you. But the fact that the rate went up in December and it is a lagging indicator, I don't think has any great significance on where the economy is heading. If there is anything of concern, it's the fact that employment continues to fall. December was the seventh straight month in which employment has declined. And that is a little troubling, I think, to everybody, because we assumed that with November, even though employment was down, with November following the seasonal pattern for Christmas hiring, that we would get a seasonal pattern for Christmas hiring in December, and we did not. We were a little short of the seasonal pattern, the seasonal level. And if you go back and compare it to, we've had a discussion this morning about what's the normal economy for Idaho, and we've kind of thrown out 2000, this decade of 2000 as normal because we were stagnant, we were booming, and we were busting, but we weren't really anywhere stable in there. 90s are close because it was a totally growth. We had a little slowdown in 94, but almost pretty much steady growth through the 90s. 80s was steady decline. And 70s, we decided probably 70s is the best you can get for a normal economy in Idaho, and our statistics don't go back far enough to really get a good handle on the month to month. But if you go back to the 90s, which is a good growth period, and probably one that we'd like to see repeated because it was steady, at that point, sustainable growth. Our November to December job loss, and we always have a job loss, but our November to December job loss was twice as great as it would have been in an average year in the 90s. So I think what this report does is it reconfirms what we've known all along since spring, is that we still can't figure out how to bounce off the bottom of the decline, and we're still waiting for that one thing that's going to pick up employment and drive us back towards expansion.
Thank you. Committee, any further questions? Seeing none, thank you again. Committee, next on our agenda, we have Kathy Holland-Smith. Welcome, Kathy. Thank you for your patience. Appreciate your time and effort, and when you're ready, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I won't be able to answer the questions as have been posed to the other presenters, but my goal today is to give you an overview of what the state budget is compared to the expected revenues, at least those that we're aware of for FY11, and then some of the challenges for FY12. And I know that each of you, I believe, have a copy of the handout, the PowerPoint, so if the numbers look too big or too little on the screen, hopefully it will help. Some of our legislators have seen this information. This is not totally unlike what has been presented to the Legislative Council and to the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee this fall and at the Associated Taxpayers. We're trying to continue to refine the information as we go along and try to help answer any questions and frame what the budget has looked like for these last several years. But I think from a budget standpoint, this chart that I have before you really shows how dramatic it has been. State budgeting does best in a very, very stable environment. And that's because we budget quite a bit in advance. We, through the legislative session, and we budget best when legislators feel comfortable, feel that the decisions they're making are based upon a revenue number that is very likely to occur. And when that doesn't happen, it is extremely challenging. And so on the screen right here, you can see what happened for fiscal year 2009. We had a forecast in December of 07, right over $3 billion. Now in fiscal year 2008, we had collected $2.9 billion, so it was $100 million more, $95 million more than what we collected. And it was extremely optimistic. very, very quickly after that forecast came out. We had a revised forecast in February of 08 that had never occurred, despite other times when we had challenges and changes in the economy. And each one of those marks show you, as a new revenue forecast came out, what occurred, and it went down dramatically. Eventually, we collected $2.4 billion in revenue. That represented $444 million less than the prior year, or a negative 15.3%. This has been a very difficult time in terms that we had to make budget cuts, we had to use our reserves. We did have some stimulus that came through, and I'll show you the impact of that, because not all of this could have been absorbed through budget cuts alone, and that's what the reserves, the intention of the reserves were. 2010 comes along, the same thing happens. We have a fairly optimistic $2.6 billion forecast. We eventually end at $2,264,000,000. Now, in each of these 2 years, the last time that the legislature had an opportunity to look at a forecast, your response was to set a general fund budget that was substantially less than what that forecast suggested. So you did have, you were prepared for the loss of revenue, but part of your solution was to use up those reserve funds, and you'll see what happens. Now, in 2011, the real challenge is we began with a $2.4 billion forecast, where August we went to $2,369,000,000. The legislature forecasts are used, budgeted to a $2,290,000,000 figure. And so fiscal year 2011 is not problematic, because we're actually, at this point, collecting revenues that are a little bit ahead of what the executive forecast said we would have in August of $2,369,000,000. The key is how much do we really know about the significance of the forecast, especially with the jobs news that we're having. And we rely heavily upon the spring. That's when we have our big collections. April is our big collection month. And we are somewhat at risk and remain at risk because we don't have a backup plan if those revenues don't come through. But we are, unlike many other states, not in what we would call a budget crisis for fiscal year 11, and that is because we changed our expectations so dramatically last legislative session. And it happened, and based on prudence, quite frankly, regardless of how you feel about the revenue forecasting process, it has made a huge difference. Many states are in a crisis right now and not getting through fiscal year 11. But we still have some challenges. And you can see from the screen what I've got listed are the state agencies and ranked in order. Now, the first five lines, public schools, health and welfare, Medicaid, colleges and universities, Department of Correction, and health and welfare, represent 84.5% of the general fund budget at this time. The remaining agencies, top 13 agencies, represent 93.5% of the budget, and the lowest 40 agencies represent 6.5%. And yet you can see where the largest cuts have been, and that is in the lowest, smallest agencies. And it's fine to cut everybody across the board in which the approach that we've taken. It's fine to look at programs that may not be effective or not as high on a priority. But our challenge is that when we look at public school support, and I would particularly say also with Medicaid and the Department of Correction, that we still have demographics pushing against those budgets. We're right now not looking for public school support. As a matter of fact, demographics show that we'll have increased demand for new classrooms, and that our school-age children, the ages, we're peaking out on the teen years, but we've got another baby boom coming. When it comes to the Medicaid, we know we have pressures on population, and we have pressures because the federal government has put in place guidelines that state that we can't cut certain programs. As a matter of fact, we have to expand some of our eligibility. Colleges and universities, we have not been funding enrollment growth, even though there's been very high pressure, too, That has not occurred for the last several years. Department of Correction, the pressure there is that we have been keeping that population fairly flat, but we did make some commitments to open up some new institutions, specialty type of institutions for substance abuse and so forth, and those are coming online. I'm going to show you here on the screen, you can see how much of the, both the state reserves, and they're in the brown, and I apologize, when you look closely at your handout, you can see the difference between the brown and the green, and then the federal assistance is in green. But you can see how much public schools and higher education relied upon not only reserves, but the stimulus dollars. In FY11, those stimulus dollars that are in, highlighted in red, and that's $4.8 million from the Title 14, $51.6 million in the Jobs Fund, and then the $12 million in Public Education Stabilization Fund, none of those dollars were committed to be replaced. When these decisions were being made as to recognize the stimulus dollars and pass them through, there was never a commitment or an expectation that those funds would be replaced. Now, I can speak to the $7.4 million on the general government Title 14, and we use that for enrollment growth in public schools, and so that will be something you'll have to consider again in fiscal year 2012, what approach you want to take. Then look at the rest, what the rest of government received. And you can see what happened made a big difference for us, first of all, in fiscal year 2009, which gets lost in much of this discussion, is that we came in with a $239.5 million general fund cash balance. If we had not had that going in addition to the reserves, we would have been in an extremely different situation. That was highly unusual. So we not only had our reserves at what I would consider full, we also had a substantial cash balance. And then you look in 10, fiscal year 10, we relied heavily on our reserves and the stimulus. Fiscal year 11, it goes down a little bit, and quite frankly, that's because of the availability. We had used them up. So in total, over this period of time, we've used $1.2 billion in reserves and in our cash and stimulus, and that is significant in the size of our budget. So what happens for 2012? Well, we have funding that we used for 11 that we won't have for 12. We also had solutions that were one-time in nature that we may or may not have for 12. It's going to be dependent upon the choice of the legislature. And I want to make sure that you also know that this is a very bare-bones approach that I'm showing you. You'll be getting the governor's recommendation. The governor will obviously have a perspective as to what direction he wants the executive branch and the state to go in. So I'm not speaking to that. I'm just trying to identify those things that we did in 11 that we may either have to reconsider for 12 or not have available. And number one, I'm going to just talk about the one-time fund balance is $90.3 million. Of that, budget stabilization was $30.1 million, economic recovery reserve $48.8 million. Those funds are now gone. General government stimulus, we used $7.4 million for public schools and $2 million for personnel in the Department of Correction. And then we took additional money from ISP, we used their choice funds, and we took away $2 million of general funds, and so the expectation is that would be replaced in 2012. Also, we relied upon temporary revenues. Now, with health and welfare, that was $139 million in fiscal year 11. You are all aware that that no longer, that enhanced federal matching rate is going to be available after the end of fiscal year 11. It's being ratcheted down right now. The agency does have a request for FY 2011 of $29 million to use Millennium Funds to pay for the change in that federal matching rate. But for fiscal year 2012, there's a full request of $139 million. The judicial branch has $4 million based on the emergency surcharge. They will have that until 2013, but that is looming. We relied upon one-time solutions. We took $14.8 million that we did not fund, and we took it out of agency budgets because we had reserves from our insurance reserves, and we used that, and we also gave ourselves a premium holiday along with the individual premium recipients, the employees. And then we delayed the fund shift off of the fuel taxes for the Idaho State Police and the Parks and Recreation of $20.3 million. That was for 1 year only. That's something you may have to consider again. And then we also took action to the budget process that was temporary in nature. It was legislative intent language. And both for the Department of Health and Welfare, primarily for Medicaid and for public schools, there will be a need for the Germaine Committee to be very, very involved to decide how they want to approach, if the solution is the same as what the legislature did last year, or are there other solutions to find the savings that need to be necessary to maintain the budget levels that have already been set. And then we had one-time appropriations. We had $4 million for the catastrophic health care. That's coming back again. They have a $7.2 million request for a supplemental in 11. And the tax commission is, we funded the initiative to add auditors with one-time money because that's all we had. There'll be an expectation that that be restored at a cost of $2.8 million. So in total, that comes to $270 million worth of challenges that we have for 2012. In addition to that, there are other new requests in the budget at this time, and these are, I believe, I would call them minimized, because I am just identifying those things that were funded last year by the legislature. There's much more in the agency's request, but I'm only identifying the things that I know that you addressed last year, and so I want to make sure that they're put before you to see what likely would occur, and that is public school enrollment growth of $22.9 million. That includes their 250 support units and the transportation costs. Medicaid growth on top of that $139 million, an expectation of $33 million that would take care of caseload, utilization and pricing, mandatory pricing increases. And then corrections growth, $6 million. Catastrophic health care, another $6.4 million. And then if the tax auditors were phased in, phase two of the tax auditors were completely funded, you'd need $1.2 million. And that's the difference between what we funded last year and this new year. So that comes right at $339.5 million or $340 million. The key is that can be addressed in one of two ways. We will expect additional revenue or not expect additional revenue. We can make additional cuts, and we can look for additional fund sources. The Millennium Fund is the most obvious one, the non-endowed portion that people have been discussing, but there may be other fund balances that the legislature chooses to look at. I'm going to quickly look at 2012 and what it might look like. And it's really going to be, this is my hypothetical based on discussions that we've had last several months. But the very first column, I show you how we build the revenue scenario for 2012. And I'm assuming that actually in both of those first two columns that there's no beginning fund balance coming in from 2011. And a hypothetical that if we use the Economic Outlook Committee's previous recommendation of $2.290 billion, then what would actually happen with a 3% growth on that? You'd have $2.355 billion. And you have to consider the next phase, the grocery tax credit, and we also have a new education credit that was approved last year of $5 million. So those are pulling down the revenue numbers a little bit. And then the middle column, what that represents, it says, you know, maybe it won't be 1.8% in 2011. We're going a little bit more positive. Let's go to 3%. So if I build a 3% revenue number over a 3% in 2011, then I come with $2,382.5 million. Now, right now, we have a 4.7% for FY11. If we use a 4% growth for 12 and assume that that 4.7% in 11 holds, which I think is too optimistic, is you'd have generate $2,461 million. Partly the reason why I think it's the 4.7 remains optimistic is in the October forecast pulled down our personal income growth substantially, and also based on the news that we've been hearing, I think that remains a little bit of an optimistic number. But what happens if you do raise revenue, if we raise our revenue up over 4%, if we're fortunate enough, it does trigger a statutory transfer from the general fund to the budget stabilization fund. And that's when we have revenue that's over 4% and then up to 1% of the prior year's revenues should go to the budget stabilization fund. If that occurs and you don't want that to happen, the legislature would have to pass a resolution delaying that. Now, put that against the request. You've seen this request over time, and what I try to highlight on are those issues that I have brought up previously as being critical. and compare that against some of the major categories of funding that haven't been addressed in the last couple of years. And so, number one, the benefit costs with health insurance and Percy, based on the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee report that we received from Percy and from group insurance, I think, and also the board, most recent board action on Percy, I don't believe that we'll be funding those this year. We'll also begin to look to reserves. I think that's very likely, and we've been saying that for several months. I don't see inflationary increases. I don't see any funding for replacement items. I also highlighted coming on down, a statewide cost allocation is just a mathematical way that we collect from agencies services that they receive from central service agencies. That's going down because we've cut the agency's budgets who deliver those services. So we're collecting less back, and we'll be cutting appropriations in according to that. I don't see anything for a change in employee compensation. That dollar amount, the 14.2, represents both a 1% for public schools and for state employees. I don't see that happening. I don't think anybody else does. Public school enrollment and transportation, I think that would likely seriously be addressed. Professional technical, seriously addressed. That's part of the public schools appropriation. Higher education workload adjustment, I don't think that would likely be addressed if you follow the same path that you've been following. Health and welfare, FMAP caseload pricing, that has to seriously be addressed, or changes in policy. Public schools replace the ARRA funds. I think that's going to impact salaries and benefits. You'll probably have to seriously address that. The CAT fund, Department of Corrections, I think it's unlikely, based on what the Governor's Task Force on Transportation addressed and the most recent discussions when it comes to Parks and Recreation, Idaho State Police, that we'll be able to use the general fund to pay for those services received from those agencies. I think the Tax Commission, phase two of the auditors, has to seriously be looked at, just so that we don't lose ground on our tax collections. And then I'm assuming all other requests for funding won't be considered. Now, if you look at that and you look at what does that mean for all the things that I've highlighted, those issues that I think won't be addressed equal $166 million. So you're still talking about a $200 million problem that you have. I mean, that $200 million comes back again. We've been discussing it for the last year. It's fairly predictable. We knew that this was going to happen. We knew this would happen. I think the challenge we all face is that the slowness in the recovery has really struck home with the states. If you look at this last slide, what I've done is just compared those agencies that, in the cuts that have been taken already, statewide total of 19.4%. You can see where some of the agencies have not been cut as much, but you can see that FY 2012 requests compared to their 2011 original appropriation. And a big challenge for us is public schools, obviously, 14.4% cuts without continued stimulus dollars to keep that up. Now, we do have the Education Jobs Fund, and about half of that probably will be available in 2012, and that will be a positive for public schools, but that's still going to have public schools deal with all the choices that have been made over these last couple of years in the sense that there won't be anything to prop them up. But when it comes to that second line, health and welfare, Medicaid, that's a big issue. You're going to be looking at a budget that was at $400 million in 2009, was down to about $300 million because of the FMAP shift. Now, when we took that money away from health and welfare and we used the federal dollars, it benefited everybody. Everybody got the benefit of that cut. And then you look at the increased pressure to $471 million. They've been taking cuts in Medicaid all along, so they have not been held harmless through these budget cuts. They've been taking their share of the cuts all along, but now we have the situation with the federal matching rate changes. And that's probably the single largest issue other than public schools that you'll be facing. I think that's where the tension will naturally be. The other area is the catastrophic health care. You can see it's almost to the very bottom of the screen. That goes from an $18.2 million appropriation in 11 to $31 million. We have real pressures, and I would tell you that when I look at the statutory budget, pressures between automatic increases because of demographics and school and classroom size, we have pressures that we cannot meet in education and in higher education enrollment and these medical costs through Medicaid and the indigent program with the type of revenues that we're going to be collecting, not only next year, but in future years. So as we talk, there's been more and more discussion about the expectation that this would be a new baseline. I can tell you that the pressures to push over that new baseline or that are very, very, very high. And until we either, number one, don't put or can find a way to put some of that off of autopilot and change what we do, I don't know how there'll be satisfaction. You'll continue to play catch-up or try to play catch-up because those needs continue to outpace, not only in Idaho, but throughout the country, the expectation to pay for those services and the way they've been paid for historically. So I apologize. I have not been able to give you probably the news you'd like the last couple of years. If I can answer any questions, I'll be glad to.
Thank you, Kathy. Any questions from the committee? Senator Lefebvre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I take Kathy's words pretty soberly because in years past I've looked at her budgets and thought there's no way we can do this. And she always says, yeah, there's a way we can do this. And this year you're kind of telling us there isn't a way we can do this without more revenue. And I'm kind of surprised by that. I take that very seriously. I'm imagining the discussions around tobacco are not enough to get us there. And so,
if I could, Senator Lefebvre, I want to be clear. I'm not saying you need new revenue. What I'm saying, you have to look at the whole system. I think that you'll continue. We have relied on other state dedicated funds the last couple of years. I think that we'll be looking under every rock and any rock to continue that practice. But it will be the policies, the underlying policies that will have to drive the budget rather than the budget driving the policies.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Kathy. I want to go back to the jobs education bill that Congress passed this summer, $51.6 million. Can you clarify for me whether that was non-cogged and put into the budgets directly in the FY11 budget, or would that come in the form of a supplemental with carryover authority for 12 as well?
Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Roberts, committee members, that was actually non-cogged, the short term. So that means that the Division of Financial Management gave the Department of Education the authority to receive that money and appropriate that money for public schools and pass through. We thought originally that money would be passed through without any barriers. It ended up that the federal government actually made it on a reimbursement basis, so it's not being spent as quickly, the $51 million. We thought it would clearly be spent within 12 to 18 months. I think it's probably going to push into 2012, clearly now, because a reimbursement basis means you have to spend your own money and then ask for that money back, and that's a whole different dynamic than just getting the money free and clear.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, do we have any indication from the school districts of how many of them have actually used either all or what percentage in the FY11? How many of them have split it between 2 years? Because there is a time frame of, I think it's 27 months or something like that, mm-hmm. that they can actually spend it. Can you give me a feel for where they're at?
Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts. My understanding from Paul Headley, who's been tracking this pretty closely, is we're about half. That they expect to spend about half in fiscal year 11 and then spend the remaining throughout not only 12, but the further months out.
Follow up.
One more follow up, Kathy. Half may mean different things to different districts, because you may have some districts spending 100%. In FY11 or 90% in other districts, you know, going the other way. So if they're going to have the assumption that that money will continue, the experience for some districts may be that they have not much of a gap in 11 or in 12 budget, mm-hmm. and some districts may have a substantial gap. Can you speak to that?
Kathy.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you're absolutely right. School district by school district is different. And I know that my understanding is they're trying to collect through the superintendent's office that information from the school districts as to how much is spent. And our goal would be to have that information for the education committees and for the joint committee shortly after the beginning of session.
Senator Bilyeu.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Kathy, I think my initial question was answered with what is in the Education Jobs Fund, what's available, and I guess that was the $51 million. Is that correct?
Kathy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bilyeu, that's correct.
Follow-up. Could you tell us some of the other sources, like the Millennium Fund, what's in there, and what other sources there might be for us to look at?
Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bilyeu, right now, primarily the Millennium Fund, the non-endowed portion, we're expecting about $80 million. We think there may be some softness in the interest that's been projected over the next couple of years, so we're looking right at $80 million. And other than that, you'd have to go to each and every other dedicated fund and look specifically at it, all of which right now have purposes that are spoken for in Idaho code. And you would have to say, notwithstanding those purposes, we use that money. We do not have any other surplus dollars at this time.
Last question from Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to follow up with the question that Senator Bilyeu asked. If those dollars, I'm going to lose my point that I'm trying to make. I'll catch it. I'll come back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Roberts. I know the feeling.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Kathy. We appreciate it, and I know that you're always available. Appreciate that as well. And next on our schedule, committee, we have Dan John here from the Tax Commission. Welcome, Dan. Thank you for your patience. As soon as you're ready, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I would like to once again make the request that I not follow Kathy next year if I do this again. Mr. Chairman, you should be receiving two handouts. One of them will be my revenue estimates for the next year and a half, and the other one will be dealing with the Economic Estimates Commission. I'm not sure that many of you know that even exists. I have been asked to explain that to you and let you know the purpose of that fine group. Mr. Chairman, if you have your handouts, it's going to be a little hard to follow me through the first one, so I'll just talk and see where this goes. And this deals with the Idaho Economic Estimates Commission, and this comes to you from a Senate bill from 1980. That was Senate Bill 1262 as amended in the House. What this bill did, first off, was designated the Idaho Tax Commission to be the Economics Estimates Commission, or established the Estimates Commission and designated the Tax Commission members to sit as that group. It had a fairly simple mission that it was to accomplish, and what that was is each year before January 1, the Tax Commission, or the Economics Estimates Commission, is to provide to the legislature, the governor's office, a number that is used as a limiter on budgets, and that number is total personal income for the state of Idaho. Total personal income is an economist term, and if I might read, Mr. Chair, I'll read what that means, because I'm not an economist. Total personal income is defined by the United States Bureau of Economic Analysis is income received by persons from all sources, and includes income received from participation in production as well as from government and business transfer payments. It is the sum of compensation of employees, supplements to wages and salaries, proprietor's income with inventory valuation adjustment, capital consumption adjustments, rental income of persons with the capital consumption adjustments, personal income receipts on assets and personal current transfer receipts, less contributions for government social insurance. That's the number the tax commission is charged with coming up with. The way the Economic Estimates Commission, which is the tax commission, does this is we invite accountants from around the state to come together in December and give us their estimate of the total personal income. This last year we had a representative, Mr. Donald Hawley from Boise State University, Scott Benson from Idaho State University, Don Reading, who is a private consultant with Ben Johnson Associates, and Derek Santos from DFM came and gave us their estimates of personal income. In the past, we've also heard from Mr. John Church, and for several years, we received input from Mr. Kelly Matthews and the First Security Bank, and also from Wells Fargo. The significance of this is what I'm getting into, and what that is if you go to the code section, the one that is long, that looks like this, that's where the meat of this is. The legislature is constrained in the amount of general fund that you can budget, and you're limited to 5 1/3% of total personal income for the state. That is the limitation on your general fund budgeting. There are adjustments that can be made to that percentage, and it's due to transfers of governmental functions, either from the state or to the state. If the legislature takes over funding that was previously done by a local jurisdiction or a school, then that limitation can go up. If the legislature places funding on a local jurisdiction or a school that the state had previously been paying, then your maximum that you can budget goes down. And lastly, if feds provided by the federal government are eliminated that have been coming to the state, you can increase the state's general fund budget to make up for that. This is a very important provision. If you go to the chart, there's a chart, and this comes from the Division of Financial Management out of their general fund budget book. It shows you what the estimate was from the Economic Estimates Commission. Shows you also what your maximum budget limit was at that point in time, and goes through the adjustments that have been made since in this chart since 1965. Some of the most notable of these, in 1999, there were a couple of them. The most notable of these was that was when the first 1/10 of 1% of the public school property tax levy was taken over by the state. That increased the amount that you could levy for the general fund. In 2007, you have a $250 million increase to this. And that was the last phase where the state took over the remaining 3/10 of 1%. That was coming from local tax dollars, and the state took that over and built that into the appropriations. If you use this chart, you will see that there has only been one year that the legislature really was in jeopardy of being in violation, and that would have been 1992. And in response to that, the law was modified slightly to take one-time expenditures outside of the cap, and that kept you actually under that budget limitation cap. But going by this, based upon 2011's number of $51.6 billion, you would be able to actually budget from the general fund $3,413,000,000. So you are nowhere close to that for what you budgeted for fiscal year 2011. The last sheet you have shows in the shows the year, then it shows in the middle column the number that was estimated by the Economic Estimates Commission. And the far right-hand column, excuse me, the middle column is the actual Idaho personal income, and the right-hand column is the amount that was estimated. That's why on the bottom there are some years that aren't filled in, and shows what the Economic Estimates Commission estimated versus what actually happened. Looking at this, because I hadn't looked at this very closely, it looks like other than a couple of years, we generally underestimated what total personal income was going to be. Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions about that. Mr. Houston asked me if I'd give you a short primer on that, because it is around. It's a limiting factor on what you can budget, and our feeling was that there probably was a lack of knowledge on that group.
Thank you, Dan. At this point, any questions from the committee? And at this point, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I will give you the first set of actual numbers, I believe, that you're going to receive for the year. I am here representing the Tax Commission. The estimates you're about to see are coming from me, and the methodology I use is I look at the most recent year's data and then look at historic revenue patterns and come up with my estimate of revenue for the ensuing year. I do have a little bit of an advantage in that I get to see some of the preliminary numbers for December over some of the other presenters. The first sheet you have is preliminary data that's come out for the month of December. And I'll just run through these quickly and give you the numbers and some of the changes over the prior year. Individual income tax, we had about $552 million to this point. That's up about 18 or 3.5%. Corporate income tax is doing well. It's just under $60 million, about a $14 million increase. That's up 32% over the prior year. Sales tax is up slightly over it was last year. It's running about 2.4% ahead. Going down through some of the product taxes, beer and wine are remaining pretty flat from what they've been in prior years. Cigarette tax is down a little. I will remind you, this is a statutory number. This is set in statute how much goes to the general account and doesn't go to pay to the permanent building fund to pay the state house bonds. Mine license is up. It's actually not 40% when this was typed. The decimal point kept sliding. It's actually up 400% over last year. This is the equivalent of a severance tax we have. Kilowatt hours down slightly, and tobacco products taxes are up about 12%. For an overall amount of through December compared to last December, we're up about $44 million or 4% over the prior year. So it's not lighting things up, but it's not bad. It's not dropping. It is at least stabilizing. What I would give you now is on the next page is my best guess for fiscal year 2011, and I actually have the actual fiscal year 10. Individual income tax, I would expect, looking at the strength in withholding and things we've had, to be up about 6% or to $1,125.2 million. Corporate tax, based on the way it's going right now, should be at about 127.7. This is still up about 31.6%. This would bode with the national trend. Most of the literature I'm reading is that corporations are doing well right now. They're having efficiencies that they haven't had in the past. Sales tax still remaining a little flat at up about $23 million or 2.4%. The beer and wine tax will just about even each other out, a little over $5 million between the two of those. 14.4 on cigarette tax is the statutory amount. Kilowatt hour tax should come up with what it's been through December. We appear to be having a very good water year, and that that should bode well, that kilowatt-hour tax should stay okay. Unclaimed property, which I will not report on in the future, takes a pretty good drop. Last year was an incredibly abnormal year. The $4 million that I would project going forward, coming to you from the treasurer, is about what it's been the last few years. We just had this huge blip last year, and that should just return to normal. Tobacco products will stay pretty much the same at about $8 million to the general fund, up about 2.6%. Going out a little bit beyond my comfort level into 2012, I would project individual income tax to stay about where it's been, up about $39 million or about 3.5%. Corporate tax stay really pretty flat, up about 2.3 million, just under 2% growth. Sales tax to have a little better growth than it's had, up a little less than 50 million or about 5%. The sin taxes still evening each other out at about a little over 5 million. Cigarette tax, the amount to the general fund is dropping under the statutory provision. Mine license stay about the same, kilowatt hour about the same, as with the unclaimed property and the tobacco products, for a total of revenues collected by the tax commission plus unclaimed property, which we no longer collect, of $2,354,000,000, which is just under an $87 million increase from fiscal 11, or about 3.8% increase. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Dan. Questions from the committee. Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, did your personal income factor the mega million winner in?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I've read articles in the newspaper saying that the mega jackpot winner is going to enhance the general fund. That's not true. The money that comes from that is there is a withholding provision, and that goes to the public school endowment fund. It does not go to the general fund.
Thank you.
Representative Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dan, looking at the numbers through 12/31 to 10, I guess this is my first exposure to what the December numbers were. Can you isolate the December numbers from that and tell us just roughly what the increase was in just December? It looks like maybe $8 million, but...
Mr. Chairman, actually I cannot. I didn't think to bring that. It's my understanding that this is not quite as strong a performance as it was in November. That it's still up, but not as much as it had been. But some of the numbers had weakened. I can get that, Mr. Chairman. I can get you the November comp report and show you exactly where we were, if you'd like.
And follow up from me, Dan, help with Ms. Representative Roberts, if you will. He's struggling to figure out the 2011 number, since we budgeted the $2,290,000,000, and yet your estimate of revenues is only $2,267,000,000, and we show a difference of $110,000,000. Tell us what's playing in there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lake, I only project the taxes that are collected or have been collected by the Tax Commission. This does not include some of the miscellaneous receipts, does not include the insurance premiums tax. So there's a ray, I think, in the numbers that he's put together on your chart. Does some fill-in of the things that I don't project. That's the reason you've got this. Looks like I'm up, but it would be down from what you budgeted from, and that is the reason. I don't try and project the items that we don't collect.
Thank you.
Mr. Houston.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, after the conclusion of our presenters, I have summarized the three different prognostications for you side by side, and you'll be able to see which categories the Tax Commission does not make a forecast for and which ones they do.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much. I appreciate
your
time.
Chairman, members of the committee.
Committee, next on our agenda, we have with us Randy Nelson from the Associated Taxpayers of Idaho. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate you, and as soon as you're set up, the floor is yours.
I think I'm set up. I just have a handout. It's very similar to report to what I do for 21 years now. I think I've done this report, and I sort of developed a format and stayed with it. I think the main thing with this information that's coming to you is the first and last page really gets into the guts of what I think you're looking for. But in between, I've got all this methodology and documentation for really where I was kind of coming from and maybe why my numbers are the way they are. I also have a little bit of property tax information I'll share with you, too, because I go down to the local level even. So just with that, keeping in mind, again, I'm not an economist, and I have not used a computer simulation model to do this. It's just right here in front of you, what you see is what you're going to get. The first page there is really just shows you my estimates. It shows some history in the general funds, and you can see there my 2011, 12, and 13 estimate, and I'll give you a little more detailed information on that when we get to page 10. I think the key things, if you just go to the second page there, what I do, I really follow some global, national, regional, state, and I try to keep up on the reading as close as I can, just kind of get a sense of where I think things are going. But the optimism about the U.S. economy has grown pretty sharply very recently, but it's fueled by a series of economic reports that show everything from consumer spending more freely to businesses curbing layoffs. But the housing market is still, I think, something that's pretty extremely weak, and you've probably heard about that for Idaho, too, from one of the presenters. The second Wall Street article there, it's the economy is gradually recovering. Some big U.S. companies are cranking up the recruiting and advertising. But are those jobs going to be in the U.S. is what I would ask. But they are recruiting a little more and moving that up. There's also economists that expect moderate growth in 2011 enough to reduce their unemployment rate, but it's still going to remain very high at about the 9% level. And there's some other reports that are included here about consumer sentiment. If you go to the next page, page 3, still the economy faces major hurdles. I keep seeing that in there. You'll see a little optimism, and then you'll see it's still there's some hurdles out there. The last more article, more from that national area, exports are looking pretty good as far as American products go. Our exports during the month hit their highest level since August of 2008, a month before the financial crisis struck and sent global trade into a tailspin. I followed some Idaho Statesman, I call this more national and statewide as well. I think they had a good article that Bill Roberts had done here in late December and had some business people believe things will, that the good news is that 2011, few business people believe things will get worse, but they do not believe their business or the economy will come roaring back. Slow, moderate growth is expected to come out of this as we come out of this recession. There's an article toward the end of page 3 that I used last year, actually, and I thought it was still kind of appropriate and still fit with what's going on, so I left it in here. But most economists say it'll take until 2015 for the unemployment rate to drop down to its more historical level. Even though the economy will likely keep growing, the pace is expected to be very plodding. Go to the next page, page 4. This more really comes out of the Idaho Business Review, and this was from last year, and it was just, I think, to keep in mind, we were really growing as a state compared to other states, and that's one of the key reasons I left it in there. I think even as we look at the 2010 numbers, Idaho was definitely in the top area of the states growing. The next one is from Marple's Business Newsletter. This was more in August, and it just kind of, they gave a little summary of what was going on in some of the states as they followed their readers and try to get information to their readers. But I think if you go to the next page, on page 5, they had a December 29 issue. They said in the Pacific Northwest, most of what they're reporting came from their sources, that states in our region wouldn't outpace the national economy. The next one, there is really more statewide of Treasure Valley here, but there were speakers. I always attend the Economic Outlook Forum that the Boise Chamber of Commerce does each year, and there were some presenters there, and I try to summarize that and include that with this information. But I think one of the key things maybe is what John Church reported there. The bottom of this downturn in the state and the multiple statistical area economies have been reached. However, recovery of employment in Idaho and the Boise MSA to the pre-recession level seen in 2006 and 2007 may take 3 to 4 years or as long as 5 years, depending on our national economic recovery. And I think you heard from Mike Cron today, and if you can go to the next page, I'll get into some of the local property tax information as well. This page, on page 6, what I've done here is just show the 2009 population, the assessed value for 2010, and then the change in value. And in past years, I've usually been able to talk about increases in value, and this is the second year I've been talking about decreases, pretty significant one this year. But I've also included with the top, the largest 10 counties, I've included 4 more that actually had some valuation increase in them. And that's kind of how I've always done it, and I kept that same format here. But those 4 counties are added, so basically you're looking at about a third of Idaho's counties here. But you can see they're going down that first column. Those 14 counties, when you go to the across that subtotal there for the cumulative subtotal, are about 77.4% of the total population. When it gets to the assessed value in the state, they're around 68% of that assessed value. And then when you go to the far right column over there and go down, they make up of our $11.6 billion net reduction in assessed value in the state, they make up about 7.7% of that reduction. And I think, you know, in 2009, we had about a $6.6 billion net reduction. 2008 was a $5.4 billion increase, and 2007, $17.6 billion increase. So that lets you see how substantial this recession has been. Down at the bottom of the page, this might be helpful too, if you're kind of wondering which types of classes of property had increases and which had decreases. But of the $11.6 billion there of reduction, there's some categories obviously with decreases there, and I've listed what those were. The urban rural, those are non-owner occupied residential, those are not having the homeowner's exemption, that type of property, that was the largest area of reduction. And you can see agriculture dropped quite a bit this year, mining dropped quite a bit, and timber did. That, when you total those all together, they actually are over $13 billion of reduction. There were some with an increase, which made that net $11.6 million reduction overall. But those with increases were homes, homeowners. Occupied residential had a slight increase this year. No change in commercial, industrial, basically. And then operating a utility property is one that did have an increase of 6%. If you go to the next page, this just lists by county what happened with values this year, so you can see all the counties. And you can go down there, Oneida County, you'll see a 21% increase. What was that? And I followed up on that just for your information, because I thought that question might come up. That was mostly in the operating properties area. Idaho Power, Pacific Core, and some of the communications, that's where that value increase came from primarily. but you can go down there. This is in descending value as far as increase goes. It shows the counties with increases there in that third column, and then you can start seeing the ones with decreases. And basically, the counties there at the bottom that used to have the largest increases now have the largest decreases. So that's the bottom line of this, but about a 9.4% decrease this year. You go to the next page. This kind of just gets into a long history. The last time we had the reduction in taxable value was in 1983. And you can just kind of follow through there and see in the 90s, or our centennial year, we started really showing the growth in Idaho that was going on. And then you can see sort of stabilization there for a few years. Then in 2002, it really jumped up rapidly. And all the speculative buying and everything going on. And then you can see in about 2008, things were bursting. 2007, right in that area, it started to burst. And that's when we started seeing these minus numbers. The next page, basically, I'm just going to really very quickly, this just gives you a couple ideas of how to do the forecasts. I really don't use my first method there where I sort of do what I call my 3-year straight line weighted method, but to forecast. It kind of gives me a number out there farther to look at, but I really use what I call my method 2, and it's primarily looking at what DFM has forecasted, their most current adjusted forecast. I do look at monthly trends, and then it's a lot of this reading and information that I just covered with you. That's really the basis for making the forecast. But again, you just go to the last page, and that has the forecast. It shows several other years there along with it. And I think I'll just leave it at that. The numbers are there in front of you, and let you follow that information and hopefully get you back on schedule a little bit better here. So.
Thank you very much, Randy. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your time. Committee, next on our agenda, we have a presentation from our universities. We have Professor Hawley and Stuen with us. Is that correct, Ray?
Yes. Okay, I can. Where's the voice coming from? Oh, I apologize. Thank you.
I was pointing up.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to the committee, and when you're prepared, the floor is yours, sir. Be pleased to introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Hawley. I teach economics at Boise State University. Scott Benson and Eric Stuen from Idaho State and the University of Idaho are attending the meetings of the American Economic Association in Denver, and so I'm the speaker of choice. And we'll see if I understand the technology. No, not that. There we go. To give you a little economics lesson, the first point I'd like to make is that the recession is officially over. What we have here is real gross domestic product over time from the first quarter of 2006 through the third quarter of 2010, and the recession began in the fourth quarter of 2007. We had a little blip there with the tax rebates in 2008, and we hit bottom in June of 2009, and we've been in the recovery mode since then. But the recovery doesn't mean that we're back to where we were before. A recovery means that we've simply started back up. In terms of real GDP, it looks like we've made some substantial gains. But the important point, I think, is to simply observe the point of recovery there in mid-2009. Here we have personal consumption expenditures in the second graph, and they too peaked out in late 2007, and they started up again in mid-2009. retail sales a little different than personal consumption expenditures. They bottomed out in late 2008, and they started gradually up. But you know, the upward trend is rather obvious, and again, a very positive sign of economic recovery in the country. Although with all these positive signs, then we take a look at employment. And total employment peaked again in late 2007, early 2008, and then had a very precipitous decline. And then in late 2009, it seemed to have bottomed out, and it started back up. And you really can't say it started back up, but it's just, at least it's not heading, it's not going south anymore. This is the total U.S. employment. If we look at the unemployment rate, it tells you the same thing. It's the inverse of it. The unemployment rate rose very dramatically from early 2008 into mid-2009, and it's just leveled off. And so even though there's some very positive signs of economic recovery, these are the indications that the economic recovery perhaps isn't as strong as the growth in GDP would perhaps indicate. One thing that these numbers don't show, and that is the duration of unemployment. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has been collecting data on the duration of unemployment since the mid-40s, after World War II, so we don't have data for the recession and the depression. But it's currently 40% of the people who are unemployed have been unemployed for more than 6 months. And a few months ago, it was even higher. A few months ago, over 50% of the people who were unemployed had been unemployed for more than 6 months. And that's the highest that it's ever been. We don't know what it was like in the Depression, but ever since 1945, I believe, is when they started, 45 or 46, we've never seen the duration of unemployment as high as it is today. This next graph is one on what the Federal Reserve calls capacity utilization. The gray lines indicate the periods of recession, and you'll notice that as we go into recession, the capacity utilization falls, and that's rather obvious, isn't it? And then as we come out of the recession, the capacity utilization increases, and the capacity utilization has started to increase, but we're still at 75%. That means there's a lot of idle plant and equipment out there. And so, again, the economy shows signs of recovery, but there are signs that the economy is still fairly weak. For the one statistic that strikes me as being perhaps the most important is in these numbers from the Federal Reserve that they report as household net worth. In late 2007, household net worth peaked at about $65 trillion, $65.65 trillion. And then it bottomed out there in early 2009 at $48.9 trillion. So between this little over year and a half, U.S. households lost $16.75 trillion worth of wealth. That's 25% of their wealth. And so you ask, how strongly will consumers come back? How strongly will we come back and start spending money after we've lost that much money? And the answer, and the implication of the it's a rhetorical question. The answer is obviously we're not going to come back very strong. As World War II ended, a little homey story, as World War II ended, Sears, Roebuck, and Montgomery Ward were the primary retailers in the United States, the Walmart and the Target of our day. And after every war, there's a recession. And the question then was, how long will this recession last? And Sears bet that it would be a very short recession and recover very quickly. and Montgomery Ward felt that it would be a very long recession. And because Sears bet that it would be a very short recession, they went out and bought everything they could and filled their stores with everything they could find. And Montgomery Ward kind of held back and said, well, we'll wait until things get better before we go out and buy. But you can imagine that after having gone through the 10 years of depression and 5 years of World War II, people had gone without a lot for a long time, and they were ready to buy. And not only that, during World War II, they'd been forced to save. So with the ration, with rationing going on, they spent what they could, but then they ran out of ration stamps before they ran out of money, and so they bought war bonds. And so after World War II, here they'd gone through 15, 20 years of not having very much and sitting on more money than they'd ever had in their lives, and they were ready to buy. And Sears won the bet, and for the next 10, 15, 20 years, Sears was really the dominant retailer in the United States, and Montgomery Ward is no more, I would imagine. Now, as far as Idaho is concerned, am I going in the right direction? We'll just skip to this is gross domestic product in the state of Idaho. We don't have it for quarters, but we do have it for years. And you'll notice that from 2008 to 2009, gross domestic product in the state of Idaho declined. More dramatically, we can look at what happened to Idaho personal income. And I plotted Idaho personal income from 1969 through 2010 into the third quarter of 2010, just to show you just how what kind of times we're going through right now. We've never gone through something like this, not in our lifetime. Our parents went through the Depression, and I guess we're going. This is one of the defining moments in our life. But never before has Idaho personal income declined. And for three consecutive quarters, Idaho personal income declined, and now we're starting back up. Look at it, rather than looking at the whole series from 69 to 70 to 2010, then I just looked at it for the last 10 years or so, and that's what we're up against. If we look at employment in the state of Idaho, I have data. This is data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's showing only through April of this year. And it's showing the percentage change from the previous year. And so starting in early 2008, the level of employment declined and continued to decline. And now it's still declining, but not declining as fast. Again, an indication that things are getting better, but still things are getting worse in some respects, but they're not getting worse as fast as they were before. We don't have data on wealth in the state of Idaho, household wealth, but these are what I have here is a table, a chart showing the median price of a single-family home. The single-family home sold in Ada County in December of 2007. It peaked at $249,900, about $250,000. By November of 2010, it was down to $150,000, a 40% decline. A few years ago, the savings rate was actually zero, or was below zero. We were spending more than we were making. And they said, how can you do that? And he said, well, we can do it because our house is saving for us. Our portfolio is saving for us. But our house and our portfolio aren't saving for us anymore. And consequently, our spending isn't going to come back as strong as it was before. Car sales in the state of Idaho. Here we have car sales in 2007, 2008, 2009, and into 2010. Obviously, the decline is rather dramatic. Here we have the percentage change from a year ago. And there in late 2008 and 2009, monthly car sales were 40% below what they were the preceding year. It's amazing. We're now back up substantially. You can the cash for clunkers hit in July So just before that, sales dropped off dramatically in anticipation of getting a better deal in July. And then they came back a little bit. So it's things look good, but they don't look all that good, is the point that I'm trying to make. When we look at just gross collections, these aren't general fund collections, but these are gross collections of the individual and corporate income, individual and the corporate and the sales tax. They peaked and they declined. These are the 12-month moving totals for these three taxes. They seem to have bottomed out, and they seem to be starting back up. And this is the percentage in these gross collections from the preceding year. Again, it looks like we've seen the worst of it, and these at least the corporate, the individual and the income tax and sales tax collections are starting back up. There we have the forecast for that we have agreed on. We feel, without looking at the at each of the individual numbers, we feel that gross collections or the gross revenues for the general fund revenues in 2011 will be up 5% from the preceding year, 5.2% in 2012, 5.9% in 2013. On the last page, we just have the detail that you can look at, but those are the numbers that we have agreed on. We feel among the three of us there was some disagreement just how pessimistic we should be, and I think I won. People in the north, the economy in the north and in the far eastern part of the state aren't as bad as they had been in the southwest and the south central part of the state. But we account for half of what goes on. And so what happens in Boise and Twin really dictates what happens statewide for the most part. And so those are our estimates. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Professor Hawley. Appreciate that. Committee members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you again for being with us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Mr. Houston.
Mr. Chairman, there are two pages you should be getting. One says the fiscal year 2011 monthly revenue monitoring, it's a one-page report, and then behind that is the general fund revenue projections working paper, and on the working paper I put in the forecasts of the three presenters that you've just heard from. But let's start, if we can, start out with the monthly revenue monitoring. This is the December preliminaries that I've just gotten from the Tax Commission, and just had time over the noon hour to put these into this format. Starting on line 10, these are the actual collections for December preliminary, $211.2 million. The last year at this time, or last year's December actual collections were 207.1. So that's an increase of, on line 12, an increase of 4.1 million. Am I ahead? I'm sorry. Does everybody have this report now? I'm sorry, Senator Bear. Okay, then starting then on the first page there, line 10, $211.2 million for the December collections, puts us at $4.1 million more than we had last December, or a 2% change. So this takes a little bit of air out of our sails. In November, we had a 7.8% increase from last November, and in October we'd had an 8.1% increase from the previous October. So this 2% increase over last December is a little bit disappointing. The cumulative change there then from last year falls, in November it was 3.9% cumulative, that's on line 15.
So in November, we had 3.9% cumulative collections over last year. And in December, the preliminaries put us at 3.6%, so we're falling back a little bit. We need about 1.8% to hit the budget set by JFAC. The revised forecast in August is the next comparison you'll see, and DFM put this forecast together. It's a 4.7% forecast over the previous year. And so lines 16 through 19 then compare actual collections to date against that monthly forecast. And you can see through November on line 18, we were cumulatively 30.9 million ahead, and now we're looking at 18.5 million ahead. And again, what I have done here is I have plugged miscellaneous revenues with the forecast, so we'll see a change there. You can expect a million or two more dollars one way or the other in miscellaneous revenues as those come in from the state controller's office. Those miscellaneous revenues include things like treasurer's interest and premium tax and some of those things that are not collected by the tax commission. And then maybe to put that in context, maybe we can go on then, Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions about the December preliminaries.
Seeing none.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, in the next page then.
Excuse me, Ray. I guess that was a little too quick to draw. Pardon me, Ray. Representative Bedke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to refresh my memory, Ray, in order to make the 2011 budget fly, what was that total? I mean, we had to have revenues of what?
Mr. Chairman, the 2011 budget is 2305.2. It's on page 19 of your information packet. And that was what turns out to be a 1.8% increase after the year end closed, lower than we thought by 15.5 million. Left us no beginning balance. And then with the transfers that have already been made from the Budget Stabilization Fund, the Economic Recovery Reserve Fund, and if you were to assume no supplementals, we'd need a 1.8% revenue growth to hit that 2305.2.
Follow up. Again, that's on page 9?
Page 19.
No, 19.
Page 19, there's two parts. There's two columns there. One is a sine die column, and that's the budget, the revenues that were assumed, and the budget that was set by the legislature. And then the next one is a scenario that I put together for you based on a 4.7% revenue increase. And if you had a 4.7% revenue increase over a beginning balance of essentially zero, we have that 1.5 million of health and welfare carryover. That could put us, and this is the scenario one, looks at deficiency warrants of $3.4 million, supplemental requests of $25.6 million, potential there of having a $37.6 million ending balance. And Kathy went into a lot more detail of potential scenarios of what might happen there if you use different revenue assumptions.
Okay. There's also the 2305 I'm good now.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember my question now. Actually, no, this is for Ray. The sales tax revenues, and Dan, you might help to jump in here, but the sales tax revenues that happened during December, are they due and payable to the tax commission on the 20th of the following month? So are we seeing sales tax revenues in this report of November, or are we seeing them partially of December?
Mr. Chairman, these are the November collections of sales tax.
Thank you.
And you'll see, Mr. Chairman, you'll see on line 20 then, the sales tax is actually for December is $1.2 million less than last December. which is disappointing.
Any further questions, committee? Ray?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, then on the next page, this is the general fund revenue projections. The first column, you'll see there, fiscal year 2010 is what was actually collected by category, individual income tax, corporate sales tax, product tax is also, product taxes also include the liquor profits, and that's one thing that is not collected by the tax commission. So in Dan's forecast, you'll see that I plugged product taxes. Also in miscellaneous revenue, there are a lot of those areas that are not collected by the tax commission. So when we get to the area, I plug the miscellaneous revenue for the tax commission. But starting out then, the next column, this is under fiscal year 2011, the current fiscal year, the August revised forecast of 4.7%. The components of that are 6.4% for individual income tax, 27.3% increase for corporate. Sales tax was 2.2%, product tax is 1.9%, and miscellaneous revenue down 9.8%. That is the second column. Is everybody following me with where the governor's August revised forecast is? And then the next three columns, in the next one we have the associated taxpayers. They have individual income tax at 6.2% increase from fiscal year 2010. Corporate income at 25.5% increase, sales tax at a 2.4% increase, product taxes 1.3%, miscellaneous revenue at negative 4.6%, for a total of 2373.6%, which is a 4.8% increase. So they're looking at about $4 million more than what the August revised forecast is. Under the tax commission, they're looking at a 6% individual income tax, 31.6% corporate, 2.4 sales tax, and then I plugged in that 41.9 million, and it's just a rounding thing there, but that's a 1.7% increase, and I plugged in the 97.8 million again from the August revised forecast for the tax commission. So their overall change is 4.7%. And it's just rounding difference there, being just like the governor's recommendation, but in different categories. And then the universities, we have a 4.7% increase in individual income tax, 21.6% in corporate, 4.1% sales tax, a reduction of 0.9% in product taxes, 4.3% increase in miscellaneous revenue, comes out to a 5% increase for fiscal year 2011. And then you can follow across there for 2012, associated taxpayers was at 4% increase over there. 4.8%. So these percentage changes are relative to the individual prognosticators. The tax commission increase would be a 3.8% over the 4.7. The universities would be a 5.2 over the 5. And then in 2013, the associated taxpayers have the 4.5. The tax commission did not make a 2013 estimate, and the universities have it at 5.9. And what I have, Mr. Chairman, if there are questions there, I can move on. What I wanted to get you to was the spreadsheets that I would like you to fill out and have to me by Monday morning before we get the state of the state message. You can fill them out and print them off and sign them. That's really the preferred method. That way I've got your signature on a hard copy, or you can email them to me if you want to take this with you and work on it as homework over the weekend. But I'd like to have it Monday before the State of the State. And I'll briefly, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll show you on the website. I've emailed this to you. You should all have it. If you want to share it with someone else and get some ideas from them, you can point them to our website. The spreadsheet is available on the website for some people to pull up and use. And I put together three tabs in there, three different ways. You can either work from the bottom, looking at just the total changes. You can look at the categories by percent, or you can look at the categories by total dollar amounts. So that'll give you different ways to work through that.
Thank you, Ray. We do have a question here. Senator Getty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ray, I'm looking at the two sheets that you passed out, and I'm looking at line 19 on the monthly revenue monitoring, where it shows 1.6% cumulative change for DFM. If I'm looking at the other sheet, is that number 4.7%? And I understand 4.7 is for the fiscal year, and this 1.6 is only half the fiscal year.
That's, Mr. Chairman and
right.
Senator Gay, that's exactly correct. This percentage change is the percentage change over the governor's forecast. So you'd say 4.7%, and you'd have a multiplicative effect, you might say, of another 1.6% in that half year. If you look at column or row 17, the final column over there, 0.8%, if you were to look at where you were right now by DFM's forecast, you'd be another, if everything else remained the same for the remaining 8 months, if all those months hit the August revised forecast, you'd be at 0.8% above the 4.7%. Are you with me?
I lost you in that last sentence. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Getty, if you'll follow then on line 16, we're $18.5 million cumulatively ahead of the August revised forecast. That amounts to 0.8% of a full year's general fund. So if we were to take the remaining months, January through June, and we got every month the August forecast for each of those months, then we'd hit the 4.7, and then we'd have another $18.5 million on top of that.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Houston, on the worksheet you emailed us, one of the options is just to put in the percentage for the total. Is that all you need is the total number, or do you want the breakdown for my category?
Right. Mr. Chairman, then, the way that I summarize the committee's numbers, I summarize them by total. But you may find it helpful as you work through that we get to look at the governor's recommendation next Thursday, and you may find it helpful to have your thoughts of what you were thinking on those individual categories. But what I need really is that bottom line number.
Any further questions? Okay, Ray.
Would you like me to demonstrate the spreadsheet for just a moment? And that's really all I have.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay, so on our website then, let me pull this one up. This is the working paper. Each of you should have this. You've got to have Excel loaded on your machine. And so under this scenario, it says total percent, and that's all you would do. You would just enter the totals. It would not give you any breakout on the components. And let's say you thought it was going to be a 5% increase this year. All it would do is say it would put you at 2377.7, which is $113 million more than we collected in 2010. And then if you were to proceed again, so you had another 5% increase, it would show then the amount over your 2011 number. It would show another $118.9 million to show that. And then for 2013, let's say you had another 5% estimate, there's $124.8 million for every, for the 5%. So that would just give you the totals. The next option then, under this option, you put a percent in for each category. If you thought there was going to be a 6% increase for individual income tax, it then takes you down to corporate. And if you thought there was going to be a 28%, whatever you thought there was going to be, you can build your own totals that way. And it'll total it for you and then give you the percent change from the previous year. And if you think there's going to be a negative 10% in miscellaneous revenue, you can calculate. Again, this one calculates based on the individual categories, if you want to put a little more thought to it that way. And then under number three, this is the way I've done it in the past, is I had you put in the numbers. And some of you prefer to work that way, where you say, what dollar amounts am I expecting to get in each of those categories. So that's available to you as well. Say this one, you wanted to say 1065 is all you thought you might get. That'd be a 0.3% increase in individual income tax. So you can work it through the numbers or through the percentages. Please do indicate to me which of these methods you choose. In case there, you know, if there's three of these filled out, you've got different numbers in them, I need to know which one's your official one. That's why it would probably be best if you would print it out and sign it and give me the hard copy, if you can.
Thank you, Ray. We have another question. Representative McGeehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ray, I just want to make sure I understand on line 13 on our worksheet that 1.8% increase is an increase from the actual FY10 revenues collected, not the revised number that we were looking at last year.
Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative McGee, and that is correct. The first section you see there, lines 12 through 15, are a comparison to last year's actual collection. So we are running right now $40.8 million more than we collected last year. If you were to hit all of the same collections for the remaining months of the year, we would be at a 1.8% actual collections for 2011 over 2010. We would be at a 1.8% revenue.
Further questions? Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray, on the spreadsheet that shows performance for the first 6 months, line 22 from DFM forecast for December, is that a December 10 forecast?
Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative Killen, this is the difference of the actual collections for this year through December compared to the August revised forecast through December.
Oh, for the month of December.
For the month of December.
It's not a December forecast.
No.
A forecast done in December.
No. So Mr. Chairman, Representative Killen, so for example, the $11.2 million that you see behind on line 22, that is $11.2 million behind in individual income tax for the month of December from what DFM had predicted for December in individual income tax. However, cumulatively, we're still ahead $10.4 million in individual income tax.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doesn't DFM do a new forecast right about this time?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Killen, yes. Next week, actually it'll be Monday, when the governor does his budget recommendation, he will release a new forecast for 2011, and he'll hopefully give us a monthly projection for that too, so we can have something to judge against as we go into January and the remaining months of the year. But yes, this will be revised again in January, and hopefully we don't do it in February and March and, you know, keep revising it every month like we've done some years. Hopefully this January forecast will stick for the rest of the year.
Senator LaFaber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ray. I noticed you haven't mentioned the individual income taxes coming in the second half of the year, and I don't know if that reminder is something you normally make and haven't made this year, but I think we have new committee members, I don't know. That does have some impact, correct?
Right.
Mr. Chairman and Senator LaFaber, if you'll look, yes, on the page one, monthly revenue monitoring, in April, you'll see a large figure there. Last year we collected $317.5 million. The August revised forecast is $376.7 million in April. So April is a huge month and carries a lot of weight. February and March together make about the size of January, you know. So December, January, June are the fairly good sized months, but April is the one that we really rely on to be strong And unfortunately, we don't know until you've left town.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ray. Ray is always helpful and available, and I'm quite confident in the committee members' timeliness in getting their work papers or their sheets to Ray. And please note that our follow-up meeting scheduled for next Thursday, January 13th, is in a different committee room. And if there's no further business before the committee, I appreciate everyone's hard work today and look forward to seeing everybody on Monday. Meeting stands adjourned.